Hello and welcome to Love is the Message, a podcast about music, the dance floor, sound systems and countercultures. I'm Jeremy Gilbert. I'm here as always, well, not always, as usual, with Tim Lawrence, my friend. Hi, Tim.
You sound jaded.
If I sound jaded, it's because we're recording two episodes in one afternoon and we're getting a bit tired.
Oh, it's not because you're bored of me.
No, it's because we've already been recording for an hour. So we're tired. So I don't need to ask how you are. I know how you are. You're fine, but a bit tired.
I'm fine, except I've got a bad cough, but I'm doing my best to repress it.
You're doing very well at repressing it, actually. Yeah, it's been going on for a while, this cough. So we're carrying on from last episode's discussion of the genesis of hip-hop. We got as far as talking about the break beat, but it is time now to talk about the origin, the beginning of that other central phenomenon of early hip-hop, break dancing. Despite the fact that I had a tracksuit and a roll of lino like everyone else in the early 80s, I think you know more than me about the actual origins of the term, the terminology and the practice. So what can you tell us about it?
I have to share with the listeners memories that I'd actually buried away and had attempted to forget. I'm not going to use the word attempting because that would be a bit harsh, but you basically breaking in the middle of one of the parties with David Mancuso that we were hosting at the live.
I've done it quite a few times,
when he would put on Patti LaBelle's.
But it's not really breaking. It's like, it's basic floor work. I would say it's more, you know, it's something like what people were probably doing like at the very beginning of breakdancing.
But probably not as well as you.
Probably not, no. It would have taken some time to refine those.
You were certainly the only person who I remember doing that at a loft party, but it was great. It was, express yourself as you wish to is the name. No, well, there is something interesting going on here, of course, and we may return to this very soon. About kind of some of the distinctive moves that you would find uptown in the Bronx and downtown on these dance floors, such as the loft and the ways that, across the waves of time, these traditions get to be kind of reproduced in, cities as far away as London. But yeah, I mean, first of all, just to say that some people will, purists will generally say they wouldn't refer to it as break dancing. This was a sort of a somewhat later kind of, corrosion. They refer to what their practice as breaking.
Yes. Well, that was definitely a thing, even when I was like a kid. If you were cool, you called it breaking. Break dancing was what like parents called it.
Yeah, but you are now a parent and you're not interested in being cool, so so that's all fine. Yes. So breaking grew out of, I got pretty into researching. I mean, just to recap, in case anyone's forgotten from the last episode, we are sort of like acknowledging that, hip hop was something that really came into formation as a coming together of four elements that were understood to be part of a unified culture only in 1981, effectively. And that before that, it was nowhere near as coherent. And graffiti, amongst other things, was almost entirely understood to be distinctive. And many graffiti writers have gone on record as saying, yeah, we weren't kind of into these parties at all. We had no interest in it. When rap music came along, we didn't necessarily like it. We preferred, R&B or rock music, or heavy metal. Maybe not heavy metal just yet, but anyway, certainly they would go on to. And it is where, although I don't think we're going to have too much time to get into this, I think we will refer to it in part, but, breaking was just one dance that emerged within the context of these Bronx parties. So you read most of the histories of, in fact, I would say, as far as I'm aware, all of them, of hip hop. And you would just assume that apart from some body popping that emerged somewhat later on and was inspired by kind of West Coast forms of social dance and practices, that basically what happened in all these settings is that everyone was breaking. I was always wondering about this a little bit, and indeed, it was just one of a whole range of dance styles that you would kind of see practiced at these parties. Having said that, it was a thing, and it goes back indeed to this important party that Herc started to host in the rec center where he lived. The rec center is recreational center in Cedric Avenue in the Bronx, where he lived in this period. And it was at this party that two of his dancers started to do this dance, which involved them kind of basically going down to the floor and using their hands to support, you know, a bunch of moves that would involve them turning and extending their, you know, extending their legs and practicing this kind of this dance that has gone on to be known as breaking. Breaking itself grew out of what's called rocking or up rocking, which was a Latin-based citywide style that included a bunch of, you know, moves in and of itself. One of them was called the jerk, which was a four-step sequence. And in it, dancers would basically drop down to the floor and then spring back up on the third and fourth count of the bar. And it involved battling as well. So it was a competitive kind of thing. And in rocking, you know, the battle would involve, you know, gestural insults and mimed attacks, you know, hitting or doing a kick or whatever that wasn't actually real, but was just kind of indeed mimed. So breaking itself grew out of another form of dancing, rocking or up rocking, that involved going to the floor, but it evolved it. Rocking itself, you know, is arguably went back to Bushwick in Brooklyn in 1968 with two dancers called Apache and Rubber Band, or known as Apache and Rubber Band. But a guy called Willie Marine Boy Estrada, who was a Puerto Rican dancer, who I interviewed for the last book, and I was asking about this, and who grew up alongside Rubber Band in the South Bronx, says that, in fact, yeah, Rubber Band was a Bronx native before his mother moved to Brooklyn in the early 70s. So there's an argument that the Bronx still played this kind of preeminent role in the development of this culture. But it was Cool Herc, indeed, who coined the term. This is generally understood to have happened. He coined the term B-boy to describe these two young brothers who are called Kevin and Keith, I think, who dressed in pro-keds and double-knit pants and windbreakers and hats, and who evolved this kind of rocking or up-rocking style at his parties in the South Bronx. And it should also be said that, you know, this style drew on, you know, basically moves that James Brown himself was more or less executing during, you know, his live performances in the 1960s. It's not to say that, you know, James Brown did the first breaking, but he was going to the floor and doing all sorts of elaborate moves. And this was just a wider part of the history of Black social dance. But it evolved and took root in the rec room in Cedric Avenue, and Herc gave it a name in terms of B-boys, and that kind of, you know, developed from there. I mean, also, it should be said that, you know, a lot of people in those days were watching these kung fu movies, and again, all the kind of the kicking, the moves around kicking, and a general kind of athletic dance, you know, styles were heavily influenced by these movies. And indeed, when voguing would emerge, not that long afterwards, you know, a lot of the early voguers were also kind of watching kung fu movies, sort of heading to Times Square and seeing what moves were being drawing on the moves that they could see in these films. This was a style that developed, and what emerged is that first of all, the breakers particularly liked, you know, music that had a funk element. You needed that, the tension, the sense of disjuncture that you can find in break-oriented music, or, you know, music that's more obviously syncopated or is less kind of, you know, straightforwardly aligned in terms of the rhythm that it's meaning. So it was records that basically had a funk element, and that in particular had this break, this kind of this element that we refer to many times in, you know, Love Is the Message already, and that we talked about in a little bit more detail in the last episode on the emergence of, you know, what came to be known as hip hop culture. So it was the records that had a break that were, you know, turned out to be particularly appreciated by these early breakers. And a particular anthem that they enjoyed, one of their favorite records, and I have to say one of my favorite records, and a record actually I played at the last All Our Friends party, now I come to think of it, because we were in a new venue and it seemed to be fitting for that, is Jimmy Castor's It's Just Begun. Watch me now. Feel the groove.
quite a lot of brass on it, isn't there?
Mm. And it's just like, you know, as when it, you know, it's, well, first of all, on the album, it's got this beautiful, you know, instrumental prelude with no breaks that does line. It's quite orchestral, and it lasts for, I don't know, even a minute and a half. So that's, like, I always quite like that kind of stuff. It's kind of creates a little bit of, well, it's just beautiful music. It's not about how it works on the dance floor. It's just beautiful music on the dance floor. I suppose people will think, well, when is this going to start? And then when it starts, it just kind of, it just tears everything up, basically. It's very powerful. It really hits, and you can kind of see why. Yeah, it just, well, everyone wants to dance to it. It's not just breakers. But it's raw. It's this thing that I'm, you know, personally, I'm just, you know, it's, you know, it's, this is just like some of the best music ever recorded, as far as I'm concerned. It's like, it's raw. It's, you know, it's pretty, it's intense. It's funky. It's soulful. It's charged. It's got, you know, powerful messages. You just kind of, yeah, just can't get tired of some of this music, really, I suppose. Maybe my explanation's not very good. It's got this great line in it: "Watch me now, feel the groove, into something gonna make you move."
Yeah,
you're fortunate that I didn't try to sing that. And yeah, "Watch me now." I always thought there was something that kind of was, you know, I don't really know if I'm reading too much into this, but I think there's something about these that seemed to be significant. Breaking is something that was basically not happening on the downtown dance floor. Although much of the dancing, in particular as the loft evolved, and especially when it moved to Prince Street, and especially when they had, David had the downstairs basement at Prince Street, and it became this place of expressive dancing, and you just had the most incredible things going on there, possibly in the history of social dance on some sort of level. You know, an argument can sort of be made in terms of its expressivity, certainly within the DJ-led dance movement. Not sure if anywhere has kind of gone further. Most people seem to agree, who know about this stuff, that whatever dancing was going on in the basement of the loft was more evolved than whatever was going on, let's say, the Paradise Garage. So there was some watching that would go on down in the loft, but, you know, we're sort of talking about the emergence of, you know, social dance, really, and in particular within Bronx culture in the opening years of the 1970s, and the emergence of breaking as a popular style. And this wasn't happening in DJ-led dance culture in effectively the entirety of the downtown scene. And I think it points to something that is going on that's really very different. I mean, one thing is, you know, indeed, "Watch me now, feel the groove, into something going to make you groove." As everyone knows, right, breakers would stand in circles and would tag each other. And the breaker who would go into the middle of the circle and would stay there maybe for, I don't really know if it's like 10 seconds or 15 seconds or 20 seconds. It was all about performance. It was all about being watched. A lot of these kids were coming, I mean, I say kids and it sounds patronizing, right? But a lot of breakers were very, very young. I mean, kind of, you know, basically in their early teens often. We should sort of say that many of the people who were involved in this Bronx party scene were young people. They weren't actually old enough to get into a club. And this is an age when it was still legal for 18-year-olds to get into a club in New York City. But they weren't going to do it. They didn't really have any money and they weren't old enough. So a lot of these parties were indeed, you know, Herc started off in the rec center. A lot of the parties were happening in parks and on the street, you know, notoriously with DJs kind of using kind of, you know, street lights, etc., to find a way to kind of source electricity and run their sound systems off the general grid. It was young kids who were, you know, who were basically also more agile, who were, you know, emerged as the best breakers. And a lot of them came from backgrounds where there wasn't a lot of money. And there was a sense that you were living on the margins of society. And so breaking also became this thing about sort of proving one's, you know, agility, proving one's worth, proving maybe even one's masculinity. So the watching of this was very important. And I think it should be acknowledged that this is a spectacular style. It's meant to be visible. It happens in the open generally, and it happens in broad daylight. We all had the same response, I'm sure, when we first saw breaking. You know, there's a, you know, there's lots of videos of this stuff from the early 1980s and the late 1970s when it when people started to video it, and, you know, including Malcolm McLaren videos and the rest of it. And it's like, it's extraordinary. It's you know, it's jaw-dropping, really. And it's about being seen. And so it's not really, I'm going on a bit here, I appreciate, but it's not about losing yourself in the crowd. This thing that basically seemed to be so fundamental to the emergence of you know, the beginnings of contemporary DJ culture, where the DJ is responding to the energy of the crowd, and the crowd is able to generate this kind of energy because they're no longer dancing in couples, but actually they're almost moving as one on this dance floor. But in that crowd, you're sort of losing yourself, really. You're kind of losing your individuality on some sort of level by letting go of the boundaries and merging into this group experience, and breaking is the opposite, more or less. I know this, maybe this is a somewhat crass analysis. I don't like saying the opposite, but it's there's a big contrast here. And another thing to sort of say is that, you know, in a sense, breaking was not, this is a twist on the Jimmy Castor line, it wasn't really actually about feeling the groove, because, you know, you were only in the middle of that circle where everyone was watching you for, you know, 10 or 15 or maybe 20 seconds. You know, you can't, the groove that we're more used to talking about maybe is something that you would feel because, you know, it's a long record, and then maybe you're on the dance floor for 2 hours or 4 hours or 8 hours or whatever it is. And, you know, one of the most influential hip-hop critics and writers, Joe Schloss, a friend who wrote one of the first books on breaking, notes that breaking's, you know, foundational move, which involves six steps, would often be performed out of time with the music. So it wasn't really about feeling the groove as such. So, you know, the music is the platform and it sets something off, but it's quite a different sort of dance experience to what was going on. And as we've been identifying in a few episodes on, you know, the emergence of this dance floor aesthetic in the early 1970s and what dancing involved, breaking was really quite different to that.
Music, dance, sound systems, counterculture. This is Love is the Message.
One thing to say about breaking as a practice is that it does, you know, it's the sheer physical intensity of it does generate a kind of endorphin rush. And it does, you know, it also, I think for the dancer, it is often experienced as expressing a kind of really intense, you know, a really intense engagement with the music in a way that that account slightly glosses over. I think subjectively that can be, I think that can be the case. I don't think it is, I don't think it's always about being looked at. It's about physically, it's about testing the body's capacities and experiencing, but also just experiencing, you know, music with a degree of physicality, including that contact with the floor, which is very important, with percussive music in a way that nothing else really does. But there's no question that there's no question that everything you're saying is right in terms of the culture that emerges around it. Very quickly. And one thing I would say actually is it was a feature of breaking culture when I was a kid, you know. So this was being translated via television and, you know, imported electro funk compilations and basically just rumor into like the northwest of England. So how much of it had any kind of relationship to, you know, breakdancing culture in New York of the 70s, I don't know. But there was a sense that the true breaker ought not to be thinking about the people looking at them, that you ought to be losing yourself in the moment. The freaking out was the term that was used, that the true dancer would freak out and that the moves would come as a sort of spontaneous expression of the intensity of their response to the music. So I think there was potentially a sense that that kind of that imminent, that implicit, that spectacularization and sort of competitive individualization of it was something that was problematic, that wasn't, that was somehow potentially sort of inauthentic. But of course, by that point in the history of the culture and the practice, we'd passed through long since, you know, got into the phase wherein the idea that the primary practice of breakdancing was this competitive, you know, not just narcissistic display in a dancing place, but it was just explicitly competitive, which completely reinforces the general points you're making.
I agree. I mean, I hope I didn't say it's narcissistic, because it's not about that at all. But it is competitive, and it's about, you know, it's a demo. I think it's about this. Look, you don't generally wouldn't. I don't know if you ever. It's rare to kind of go in a room and like everyone is breaking. It's something which, you know, circles form around it, and it's people come in and out. Look, I think there's cooperation there. There's camaraderie there.
Yeah, there's no question.
When the competition takes place, it's, you know, it's friendly. Usually it's not actually, you know, so all these things, and absolutely it's inspired by the music, but it's inspired by the music in a different way than other dancing is inspired by the music. Indeed, it's that raw hit that kind of sets the breaking kind of going, in a sense, rather than locking into a kind of groove until the, you know, endomorphin slot.
Yes, yes, so that's absolutely the case. Yeah, that's absolutely the case.
But the other thing I want to say is that on this, what's going on then in these parties, if there's only a... Because the other thing is breaking is difficult, right? And there's a lot of people just are going to get nowhere near pulling it off. So what does that mean? Does it mean that at these parties that are unfolding in the Bronx that only a relatively small proportion of people are actually dancing? And the answer is, well, no. The answer is no. Well, I mean, I spoke to Hank Shockley of Public Enemy for the last book, and then somehow or other, you know, as has happened before with me, planning on covering a longer period than I ended up covering. So I never got anywhere near properly talking about the rise of Public Enemy in the 80s as I was initially planning when I wrote Life and Death on the New York Dance Floor. Anyway, Hank Shockley said at the point when I was thinking I was going to really get this, a lot of this material in, that he was an early mobile DJ himself. He was working in Long Island, of course. And he said, yeah, we were constantly looking for new breaks to play because they energized the dance floor. But if your set went on for 3 hours, you might have half an hour of breaks when you're rocking it. And in between, you'd play all this other good stuff that would get people in the mood. And, you know, like Jocelyn Brown, we weren't just playing breaks for the B-boys. And Africa Islam, who we've yet to talk about, Africa Bambaataa, but Africa Islam was, you know, came to be known as the son of Bambaataa. He was carrying Bambaataa's record boxes around and became part of the Zulu Nation breakdance kind of crew. Africa Islam told me everybody who could break dance could hustle as well. So if a classic disco record came on, you grabbed a girl. And sometimes if you put on some breakdance records, people were still hustling anyway, because most of those B-boy records were only the breaks of a disco record anyway. So, I mean, there's just all sorts of dancing is going on. And it's not to downplay the importance of breaking, to say it was one of a number of dances that evolved in this setting. But, you know, I was kind of relieved to hear that indeed there wasn't just kind of a bunch of circles at these events.
But it's also, I mean, what's similar, if you see footage of Northern Soul parties from the early 70s, people are doing all these Bruce Lee kicks, and they do this floor work, which is very almost identical to the very basic early breakdancing, sort of bending the knees, getting down on the floor, so back flips almost sometimes. You know, you do that occasionally. You do these moves occasionally. Like most of the time, what you're doing just looks like uprocking. I mean, the most basic uprock move is just a sort of basic upright funk dancing. So yeah, obviously, it doesn't. It's something that's sort of supposed to happen at moments of extreme intensity, like during a general social dance practice, which is much more kind of recognizable.
Love is, love is, love is the message.
What about the class dimensions of all this, though? Because it's interesting, in some ways, arguably, you've got this slightly more competitive masculinist practice developing in a more working class context, as compared to the sort of studied egolessness and, you know, non-normative masculinity of the more bohemian sort of disco, proto-disco scenes.
Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, one thing to know is that there was not the same, anything like the same level of mobility in this period as there would go on to be in sort of later periods. So if people were living in the Bronx, it didn't mean that they never left the Bronx, but if they did leave the Bronx, often it was to go to Manhattan in order to work, and then return to the Bronx after working in Manhattan. A lot of people involved in the scene that we're describing weren't even of working age, so that might not have been the case. What we do know is that in, you know, this is just true of cities all over the world, that it's changing now that cities, the center of cities and global cities have become so expensive. So although they're accessible, people can't necessarily afford to do things there and may not have the same incentive to maybe go there. But certainly in this period of the early 1970s, we know from the loft, you know, for example, I mean, this is the kind of ultimate expression of all of these things ultimately, that it was a genuine melting pot and that people would travel from far and wide all across the, you know, the boroughs of New York City in order to go there. People felt particularly incentivized to go there, it turns out, if they were gay, because, you know, in many cases, people of color who were gay weren't necessarily ready to come out. I mean, this applied generally, I should say, that many gay men weren't out in this period. And it was particularly the case that if you're a gay person of color, you might not come out. A lot of the people who were going to dance at the loft were, you know, not living necessarily in Manhattan and certainly not downtown Manhattan, but were living in the Bronx and living, you know, Frankie Knuckles grew up in the Bronx. Larry Levan grew up in Brooklyn, et cetera, et cetera. And they would go to the loft in order to kind of congregate in what they understood to be, amongst other things, a safe space. So what you had at the loft is what I'm trying to get to. And we've sort of said this before, is a lot of diversity. I would say the loft was, you know, it was predominantly working class. But David's line was always, no one is checking your identity at the door. And David was friendly with everyone. And there was definitely always a professional contingent at the loft. And there was also a white contingent at the loft. This was very much a minority, but there was more kind of, let's say, class plurality at somewhere like the loft than you would experience in you know, just about any party in the Bronx. You know, we do know partly through, you know, the obvious visual culture of Motown that there was a rising black middle class during the 1960s that kind of somewhat accelerated during the 1970s. But to really return to the specifics of the Bronx, this was a neighborhood that was suffering, you know, terrible economic decline during the second half of the 1960s. And that this carried on through much of through, you know, at least the first half of the 1970s as well. In earlier episodes, we've tracked the way that, you know, white middle class people had already started to kind of leave, you know, New York City during the 1950s. And this kind of continued through the 1960s. And simultaneously, during the second half of the 1960s, more and more Puerto Ricans in particular also started to move into, you know, well, the United States in general, but in particular into New York City and in particular the Bronx, as the United States government relaxed immigration laws in 1965, you know, in many respects, in order to kind of generate, basically, let's say it as it is, more cheap labor. But there was, as we know, the late 1960s marks a period of you know, a gradual slowing down in the economy. The 1970s, there was, you know, a general stagnation of in the economy, as well as inflation, and this particularly devastated areas in parts of New York City, and in particular the South Bronx. Jeff Chang and his, you know, his classic history of the rise of hip hop culture, Won't Stop. I might be getting that ever slightly wrong.
No, that is the title.
It is a title, yes. And I was like, Don't Stop.
Can't Stop, Won't Stop.
The South Bronx basically, you know, lost 600,000 jobs during this, manufacturing jobs during this period. 40% of the industrial sector disappeared. By the mid-1970s, the average income of a, you know, a Bronx worker had dropped to $2,430, which was half of the New York City average and 40% of the nationwide average. Youth unemployment, and we are talking about many youths who are involved in this culture, hit officially 60% and unofficially 80%. At the same time, you know, there was this kind of rise of slum landlords. I mean, there's a long history of slum landlords in New York City, of course. But there was this kind of growth in slum landlords hiring people to basically burn down their buildings, largely in order to be able to collect on the insurance policy. This kind of gave birth to the, you know, this line, "The Bronx is burning," which became the title of a acquaintance of mine who was, I want to call him a friend, but we've lost touch a while ago and we didn't get to know each other that much. But Jonathan Mahler, who wrote this book about 1977, New York City, and got in touch with me about, I think, Love Saves the Day to kind of for some of his research. And that book is called "Ladies and Gentlemen, The Bronx is Burning." So, you know, there was, you know, it was on, and we've seen the images of this kind of, you know, of these, you know, piles and piles of rubble in the Bronx, you know, as kind of buildings are knocked down and are not rebuilt, and there's general poverty. Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who was a New York's Democratic senator in the period, was heard to say, report, this is in Jeff Chang's book, "People in the South Bronx don't want housing or they wouldn't burn it down." This is from a Democrat. So there was poverty, there was, you know, an element of decay. One thing we can kind of say is like, yeah, well, in these situations and conditions, people also sort of seek out hope, and, you know, and they do so often through music. I don't know if you remember, Jim, I know we both watched the Summer of Soul documentary and both kind of loved it. And in there, part of this is 1969, some of the cutaways have African Americans and, you know, Puerto Ricans basically saying, you know, well, this festival was partly put on to keep people happy because there was a lot of rising anger.
Yeah, for sure.
And it was partly about, you know, assassinations of key political figures who were sympathetic to the black community. It was partly about poverty, and it was partly about escalating drug culture. And, you know, this becoming a huge social problem that was particularly impacting on the black community and the Puerto Rican community. All of this did remind me of a book that I read quite a while ago, but I did absolutely love when I watched it. I would imagine you're familiar with, by Philippe Bourgeois, In Search of Respect, which was an ethnography of selling crack in El Barrio. This is a little bit later. And that title, In Search of Respect, was great. I mean, this is from a kind of sociologist, anthropologist. And it's like everyone was very down on crack dealing at the time, right? Because, oh, crack is awful, isn't it? And how could anyone get involved in selling that kind of thing? And what Philippe Bourgeois showed is how this became obviously an alternative economy that enabled people to, in some respects or in many respects, get out of poverty, have a sense of agency, become part of, you know, and become part of a group that had a sense of solidarity and can actually, with income, do something about neighborhood problems. And so it was in this situation in the second half of the 1960s and the first half of the 1970s in particular. And Jeff Chang details this in some detail, how basically you had this kind of emergence of, you know, a gang culture in the Bronx that became kind of, you know, a somewhat instrumental precursor to the emergence of, you know, and the flourishing of DJ culture. So there were all these gangs that were kind of flourishing and, you know, and recruiting strongly in this period. One was the Savage Skulls. Another one that Africa Bambaataa, who we'll come on to talk about in a bit. Another one was called the Black Spades. And I think the most powerful was the Ghetto Brothers, that had more than 1,000 members in the end, and also had divisions as far in places, including in New Jersey and Connecticut. So yeah, a lot of this is, you know, a lot of this is also happening, it should be said, in Spanish Harlem, which is referred to, is often known as El Barrio, which is the neighborhood of Upper Manhattan, and the north of the Upper East Side, beginning with 96th Street, I think, and then going all the way up. And, you know, the thing about gangs is that they enabled, you know, what Jeff Chang says is, you know, a structuring of the chaos. There's poverty, there's desperation, there is drug culture. And what gangs enable is you to, you know, is to feel part of a group. Basically, they operate like the mafia on some sort of level. You know, you can be critical in a very liberal way about how awful all of this stuff is and how it's an offense to the, you know, sensibility of the middle class and what have you. But also the reality is that it's a form of, you know, seizing autonomy and control and creating your own internal economy that becomes, you know, life support.
And solidarity, I would say.
Yeah,
I mean, I think a lot of that sort of work on sort of understanding the motivations for participation in gang culture, it's very useful, but a lot of the social science I've read around that is coming from this quite liberal perspective, which focuses on these things like economies of respect, status, really focuses very heavily on the extent to which, well, existing capitalism can't give people the things that it promises to successful middle-class people. So they're looking for something similar to that. But, and I think that's all true. But you've also got to stress, well, it's also giving people something that's been taken away by the destruction of working class communities and institutions like trade unions and, you know, revolutionary political parties. It's giving people a sense of solidarity, even if it's only very localized. And I think that's really also really crucial in understanding sort of gang culture. And I think that's always this, there's always this tension in hip hop, actually. I think this is hip hop in the kind of aesthetics and politics of hip hop. There's always this tension around the questionable, is this a cultural practice which is sort of filling the gap left where liberal capitalism has failed and on offering people the chance to become sort of really successful liberal subjects, to become stars, to become rich? Or is it something, is it a collectivist practice, a collectivist politics, which is about expressing a sense of social solidarity amongst people in very difficult urban circumstances? And I think, yeah, there's a sort of there's a sort of struggle over the course of the 80s up into the early to mid 90s to sort of over the question of, well, what is it? What does it mean? Which of those things is it? Which, you know, eventually arguably gets resolved in favor of a quite reactionary formation by the mid 90s in terms of mainstream commercial hip hop. But it's always there. It's always this tension. And it's this tension. Of course, and that tension gets played out within American black radicalism around the status of the street gangs. There's this persistent idea. You can probably trace it back to the 19th century, but it's a really strong idea for the Panthers. It's an idea which is still around after the LA riots in the early 90s. This idea, well, the street gangs ought to be the sort of the proto form of some new kind of wider black radical or even revolutionary movement, and that, you know, part of the function of neoliberalism in the cities from the mid-70s onwards is to make sure that can never happen, to make sure these nascent forms of black political organization, self-organization, can only ever take the form of competitive struggles over territory, competitive struggles for, you know, access to the drug markets and stuff, which I think is very interesting. And I think the drama of that tension between a sort of potentially radical, potentially solidaristic form of social practice and the fact that really the sheer power and success of the new right and their political project and the forms of neoliberalism they enable will just keep making it impossible for that potentially progressive, solidaristic form of social practice ever to really realize its potential. That really, that drama, I think, gets kind of, or that experience gets dramatized in the politics, the shifting politics of hip hop, I think, a lot of the time.
I mean, so just a note, that in 1971, you know, the competition and the violence at times is kind of happened that occurs between these gangs escalates, and referred to as the gang wars basically peaked towards the end of 1971. And it was the Ghetto Brothers, one of these gangs, that issued a call for a truce meeting, which was held at the end of the year at the Bronx Boys Club. Again, this information comes from Jeff Chang's book. And Afrika Bambaataa, who was in the Black Spades, was kind of present at this kind of truce meeting that was held. And they published a peace treaty that they all agreed to abide by. It opened to all brothers and sisters. We realize that we are all brothers living in the same neighborhoods and having the same problems. We also realize that fighting amongst ourselves will not solve our common problems. If we are to build up our community to be a better place for our families and ourselves, we must work together. We who have signed this treaty pledge peace and unity for all. All of us who have signed this peace will be known from now on as the family. And then it lists a whole series of terms for the peace. Well, it didn't hold together, but, you know, the intention was a really important one, and it didn't just kind of evaporate either. this intent towards unity, and to use the gang as also a motor for unity was really picked up by Afrika Bambaataa. So it was, you know, one of the things that really turned to be a kind of formative development for Bambaataa is when a good friend of his, a cousin who's called known as Solsky, was killed by police on the 6th of January 1975 in a kind of bloody shootout. Sometime reasonably soon after that, Afrika Bambaataa entered into a competition that enabled him to go on a trip to Africa. And there he, you know, started to kind of meet, you know, Africans, African communities, African thinkers, and returned to New York City at the end of this trip with, you know, his head, you know, with full of idea, his head full of ideas, really, and ready to sort of have a new impact on a gang that he was already kind of forming, which he referred to as the organization. And he told Jeff Chang, my vision was to try to organize as many as I could to stop the violence. So I went around different areas telling them to join us and stop your fighting. So the summer of 1975 became this kind of key moment for this. Jazzy J started to hear about Bambaataa around the summer of 1975. And at this point, Bambaataa started to refer to himself as Afrika Bambaataa. You know, obviously Africa is a key kind of reference point here. And he positioned himself as the leader of what he referred to as the Zulu Nation. Very Africanized idea of, you know, black unity, effectively, that was drawing on his experience of visiting Africa. You know, and again, to, you know, just, you know, self-plug what we've done in the past, you know, our last, you know, I think it was indeed a series 3 took us through, you know, many of the kind of, you know, nations of Africa, looking at the kind of music that was being recorded there up to this kind of particular moment. And there was a lot of very interesting socialist liberationist kind of movements which were, you know, moving through the continent during this particular era, and often were quite radical in intent. So Afrika Bambaataa started to sort of say that the job of the role of the Zulu and the object of the Zulu nation is to survive in life. There was kind of a self-help element about it. It was kind of like, be open-minded, you know, deal with all walks of life, you know, teach the truth, which he would refer to as knowledge, wisdom, and understanding. Respect those and never be the aggressor or the oppressor. Be at peace with oneself as well as others. So there's this, you know, there's these layers of discourse, all of which is happening in the name of Allah, Jehovah, to fight those who fight against you. So the Zulu chapters proliferated in the Bronx and in the tri-state area as quickly as the Black Spades had earlier. Lessons were picked up from the Black Panthers in terms of self-defense. But they were, you know, they weren't so interested in the Black Panthers' kind of programmatic demands, you know, which called for kind of, you know, housing development and new unemployment. You know, at this point, Black Power was, you know, beginning to kind of lose its hold, lose its influence. And the Zulu Nation wasn't really just about, a kind of more conventional black politics, if you like. It was also about kind of attaining knowledge of the self, let's say, which is kind of at least how Bambaataa was kind of thinking of it. And Afrika Bambaataa sort of soon entered into, basically, within this scenario, the idea that, you know, it was through DJing and through organizing a sound system, through developing kind of, you know, breaking crews, dance crews who would kind of be part of this, that you could basically deepen your sense of community through gang culture without being confrontational with others. And it soon emerged that, you know, and Bambaataa was kind of, you know, went to Cool Herc's parties, was influenced by Cool Herc's parties, the power of those parties, the sound system, the music. And, you know, he caught onto the idea that basically, rather than gangs sort of fighting one another, they could, you know, battle each other through kind of, you know, sound system competition, through DJ competition, and that it would, you know, all get in a new era of peace. And so this became major. Not very bizarrely, somewhat coincidentally, a percussionist, a black percussionist called Mustafa Ahmed, who worked with Arthur Russell and who I interviewed for the Arthur Russell book, was a counselor for Afrika Bambaataa. And so when I was doing the research of the Bambaataa book, you know, Mustafa was telling me about this kind of stuff. And Mustafa told me, and I'm, you know, I think this is probably public knowledge somewhere, but is that the, you know, New York City was putting money into the Bronx at this point to support kids and basically avert gang fighting. You know, they basically were they ended up more or less subsidizing Afrika Bambaataa and his sound system as a kind of form of social action. You know, here, we're going to give you stereo equipment and sound systems in order to kind of encourage you to just have, you know, have a good time partying rather than kind of get involved in sort of forms of, you know, basically more violent competition. I interviewed Bambaataa for the last book and he told me, I always thought music could cross racial barriers. American Bandstand was all white. And then after a while, you'd have black stars singing to an all white audience. I was thinking, if they hate each other, how come they're vibing to the music? And, you know, he was, you know, Bam was sort of saying, yeah, he was opposed to the Vietnam War, the murders of the students at Kent State University, the protests of the inmates at the Attica Correctional Facility, and the general countercultural movement's message of peace. And was aware of the damage that could be caused if gangs decided to, you know, engage in violent activities as well as more cooperative ones. So again, to sort of quote from this interview I did with Bam, when it was my time, I said, I want to try to bridge the gap between all the nationalities. I wanted everyone to dance under one roof, or one nation under a groove, as George Clinton said. So there's this idea of basically social integration through sonic integration. And Bam soon earned himself the title of Master of Records. And he would play everything. He was, you know, from Aerosmith to Sly Stone to the Beatles, the Clash. This is a little bit later on, of course, but not that much later on. And, you know, again, later on, you know, notoriously Kraftwerk. We'll come back to this later on. The Rolling Stones, Fela Kuti, Miriam Makeba, you name it, Bam was playing it. So let's listen to one of the records that Bam was playing in this period. And this is Abaco Dream, Life and Death in G and A.
Good and bad, big, small, in and out, none at all. If it feels good, it's all right. If it feels good, it's all right. Tell me when you feel it. Front and back, hot and cold, sweet and sour, young and old.
Well, let's hear a bit more of the kind of stuff Bambaataa was playing, because he's such a fascinating figure. It seems to have been quite eclectic.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay, well, let's just, because we haven't had as much music as we would like in this show. So I'm just going to, we'll hear a few more tracks that Bam would bring together. So this is Shirley Ellis, The Clapping Song, Clap, Pat, Clap, Slap.
369, the goose drank wine, the monkey chewed it back on the streetcar line.
Maybe better known, and a record actually I really love actually anyway in its own right, is Herman Kelly and Life, Dance to the Drummer's Beat. So this was a record that was popular across New York City, of course.
Yeah.
Sometimes, sorry, were you going to say something, Jem?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I could imagine David playing it.
Yeah, absolutely. That was a huge record. And, you know, but there was, so Bam would play, I mean, Bam played, you know, it's kind of, this is well known, right? That he would play anything that had kind of, you know, a sort of funky element to it, basically, especially if it had a breakbeat, but he wasn't as obsessed with the breakbeat as some, because he didn't really, Bam didn't really mix. He was much closer to David in sensibility, actually. I've always thought this is part of the argument of the last book. There was a whole bunch, you know, Anita Sarko was another who was playing at the Mud Club, this is later on, but they just had this vast range of records and they've had a way of bringing them all together. So let's have a listen to another one that the band would play. Rolling Stones, Honky Tonk Woman. And I'll do one more because it was a, you know, it was a big Bam Bouncer record and it kind of captures, you know, his ethos, if you like. And this is Sly and the Family Stone, Family Affair.
Somebody that just loves to learn. Yeah, so it is a very, you know, it's at the funk end of the loft spectrum, but it's not an unlofty sort of selection. So, and it does sort of give the lie to the idea that these early proto hip hop DJs were not playing anything that was related to disco or the disco scene, doesn't it?
Yeah, completely. I mean, this is the key point, really. I mean, I'm just trying to find in my notes, but there's sort of quite a long list of records that you could, you know, and we've played a few of them already, that, you know, you could hear in the Bronx, but you were just as likely to hear them in a sort of downtown party setting. And there was a common sensibility that was running at the time. Babe Ruth the Mexican, obviously James Brown everywhere, Bobby Bird Hot Pants, Lynn Collins Think, Simande's Bra, the Isley Brothers Get Into Something, obviously Gil Scott Heron including The Bottle, Lonnie Liston Smith's Expansions. They were all playing these records uptown, and they were all playing these records were also being played downtown. But interestingly, I mean, I obviously kind of asked Bambaataa this. I was like, so what did you think of disco? Because the whole hip hop narrative is that disco basically sucked and it whitened black music. But we'll come back to this. But, you know, the argument that I sort of managed to nail down, I think, is that this was really something that came through mainly in 1978, maybe to a certain extent in 1977, but mainly in 1978. Up until pre that moment, basically everyone was up for searching for anything that kind of, you know, had a good beat. And there were an awful lot of records that had a good beat. You know, and as Bambaataa kind of, you know, told me, and it was, you know, yeah, of course, you know, we were playing a lot of disco records. He said, where's the quote? I just found it. Yeah, I used to play a lot of disco records for the people who were heavy into the hustle. So he was kind of, you know, he was playing it. Coke La Rock, who was Herc's DJ and MC partner. This wasn't an interview with me, but I quoted it in the last book. It was like, yeah, people don't recognize this, but we killed disco. So there's just like, they, you know, disco had the breaks as much as any music that was being released throughout the 1970s, of course. These DJs were integrating all this music anyway. It would have made no sense at all if they didn't play any disco music. So, you know, the hip-hop histories basically say that the hip-hop DJs, not that they were known as hip-hop DJs at this point, didn't like disco. And it just doesn't hold any water, this argument, really. It's just something that is applied somewhat retrospectively. It's also true that they liked the funkier end of disco. But then there was, huge amounts of funky disco.
Well, I mean, this is partly why it's relevant to think about that breakbeat theory from the 90s, because partly what happens is this retrospective history gets constructed according to which there are these two completely distinct lineages, and it's floor to the floor disco going into house, trance, etc. and techno, and on the other hand, it's hip hop, it's funk leading to hip hop, leading to various kinds of breakbeat music in the 90s. And the point is, those the idea that there was this rigid separation between those things. It's a very neat theory that sort of seems to make sense from the point of view of 90s dance music culture, but it's not really at all an accurate representation of what was going on in the 70s. And so finally, where does Flash come in?
Yeah, well, we're going to deal with this briefly because we don't have a lot of time left. And also because I think as a story that only really starts to kind of break through at the, you know, towards the end of 1976, really. But Flash comes in at this period. I mean, Flash goes on to become this incredibly influential kind of figure in terms of, you know, developing what we could really call turntablism. Because if we think about it, Herc, this is well known, was not a skilled DJ. He didn't have, you know, he wasn't technical. He just had good taste in music and he knew that breaks went well, but didn't really have, you know, have much skill, particularly in putting them together. Bambaataa, likewise, it was all about the record selection and putting those records together in, you know, some sort of narrative arc, effectively, not entirely dissimilarly to David Mancuso and many other DJs. But Flash is the technical genius, primarily. And Flash came, you know, started to come breakthrough in this period as well, 1975, 1976. He was kind of initially a sort of protege or, you know, and kind of acquaintance of another DJ called Pete Jones, who worked as an English teacher in the Bronx, but was, you know, also became a successful DJ during this period. And Pete Jones was, you know, mainly working in nightclubs, and he was mainly into kind of disco music. And one of his proteges ended up being kind of, you know, it was Grandmaster Flash. And it was in the summer of 1975 that Flash, having kind of, you know, basically put a great deal of work into developing kind of his technique, mainly in a private setting. It was in the summer of 1975 that Pete Jones gave Flash his break. Meaning, you know, in this case, his debut at a spot that was referred to as Pete's Lounge, because Pete Jones actually owned this spot. And Flash had got, you know, quite serious in terms of, you know, his bedroom DJing techniques. He hooked up with Pete Jones. And, you know, I mean, what I remember mainly about this period is that from reading Flash's autobiography a few years ago now, is that, you know, Flash, again, would sort of, you know, let's say, deliver this line that he wasn't really into disco. It was too smooth. It was boring. His rhythms weren't interesting. And what he wanted was something kind of funkier. And, you know, in some respects, around 1976, 77, but in particular 78, when Flash really came to prominence, and we'll return to this in a later series, no doubt, these things come to be true. At this early point, it's, you know, this is clearly less kind of marked. Flash's debut, when he finally made it, is that he starts to develop these quite technical, you know, mixes, which is about, you know, very swift and accurate cutting. And, you know, as mythology has it, as eyewitnesses have it, his debut wasn't particularly successful. You know, the crowd basically just stood there and watched. In fact, this is what Flash says in his autobiography. Yeah, he said, "I was hoping to get, whoa, yes, I love it. But it was like no reaction, no movement." So he went on to sort of say in his autobiography, it was a lesson. You could be smart, you could be good, you could be scientific, but being smart and good and scientific wasn't going to rock a party all by itself. Actually, sorry, I think this is not from Flash's autobiography, but anyway, it's Flash talking about his experience. So Flash, you know, basically at that point started a team up with this MC, Robert Keith Cowboy, as he was known, Wiggins, who was also a former Black Spade, and started to hang out with Flash and also kind of take to the mic when Flash was performing this more technical, quick-cutting style of DJing, which wasn't so well established in the Bronx, because even Walter Gibbons would kind of do intricate mixing, between the breaks. This was also to extend the break and make the break just a kind of longer experience. It wasn't to kind of deliberately cut in, you know, what you could call even a jarring way between the records. So initially when Flesh started to do this, there wasn't, he didn't get a particularly welcoming response to the technique. But he was also, you know, in some respects, you know, in this moment, developing what we would go on to refer to as turntablism. This idea that, you know, it's the performance of the DJ in itself is a kind of thing of value, and whether the crowd dances or not is not the primary, is not the primary concern.
And are there recordings from this moment? Or we have to, I think we have to wait for a later period to get any recorded evidence.
Yeah, I think not this very moment there aren't. Yeah, not that I'm aware of anyway, but that doesn't mean they don't exist. So this is really, this is very much the end of the episode. It's actually even the end of the series. I know this is going to be very sad for many people, but we will be back.
It's not the end of the show. It just means we're having a little break for the summer.
Yes,
and we think we've finished saying what we have to say about New York 1975-6.
Yeah, we might have second thoughts, but yeah. Hopefully. Oh, hang on a second. We forgot to talk about this record that no one has ever heard of before. So, yeah. But anyway, basically, you know, Flash introduces a backspin technique. He starts to quick mix. And it involves cutting, and there are elements of scratching, and, you know, just basically transforming, you know, the audio experience through the DJ being much more active and much sharper and much more technical. And, you know, Flash becomes a truly remarkable technician and innovator. He basically is a live sampler with his turntables. I mean, I have always just been absolutely awestruck by a record that he mixed live, and I think came out in 1981, The Adventures of Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel, which we'll come back to later, of course. Yes, Flash's starts to around about, you know, in 75, but in particular in 1976, starts to introduce some of these techniques. He doesn't get an immediately popular response, but as we will return to at a later date, he soon goes on to become, you know, one of the most influential DJs in the history of hip hop, of course. And it would have been remiss of us not to kind of mention that he starts to make a sort of somewhat hesitant breakthrough during this period of New York City, 1975-76.
I mean, I think even though it doesn't get released till 5 years later, and we'll talk about it again, given that we've been spent all this time talking about Flash's technique, we should probably close out the episode with a clip from Grandmaster Flash's Adventures on the Wheels of Steel, classic that it is. Before we hear that on the way out, let's just say thanks to everybody for listening. Thanks to you, Tim, for all this fantastic information. Please share the podcast, give it a good rating on a podcast app, tell friends, sign up to Patreon if you want what is now a considerable library of extra content, or if you just want to show your appreciation. And if you don't have time for any of that, just enjoy listening to the show. Thanks very much. Have a good rest of the summer whenever this comes out. Same to you, Tim.
Same to you, Jim.
And bye, everyone.
Bye, everyone. Thanks very much.
You say one for the trouble, two for the time. Come on, girls, let's rock that.
Bad vibe, Freddy told me everybody slide. DJ is spinning, I said, my. Flash is back, Flash is back, Flash is fast. Flash is cool, Francois, c'est pas, Flash ain't no dude.
You say one for the trouble, two for the time. Come on, girls, let's rock that.